Those are mistakes in translation. Those are fanciful exaggerations by the author or copyists. We must use a new working hypothesis, one developed from the technological knowledge of our age, to throw light onto the thicket behind which our past lies concealed. Just as the phenomenon of the spaceship in the remote past is explicable, there is also a plausible explanation of the terrible weapons which the gods made use of at least once in those days, and which are so frequently described. A passage from the Mahabharata is bound to make us think. It was as if the elements had been unleashed, the sun spun round. Scorched by the incandescent heat of the weapon, the world reeled in fever. Elephants were set on fire by the heat and ran to and fro in a frenzy to seek protection from the terrible violence. The water boiled, the animals died, the enemy was mown down, and the raging of the blaze made the trees collapse in rows, as in a forest fire. The elephants made a fearful trumpeting and sank dead to the ground over a vast area. Horses and war chariots were burnt up, and the scene looked like the aftermath of a conflagration. Thousands of chariots were destroyed. Then deep silence descended on the sea. The winds began to blow, and the earth grew bright. It was a terrible sight to see. The corpses of the fallen were mutilated by the terrible heat, so that they no longer looked like human beings. Never before have we seen such a ghastly weapon, and never before have we heard of such a weapon. C. Roy, 1889. The story goes on to say that those who escaped washed themselves, their equipment, and their arms, because everything was polluted by the death-dealing breath of the gods. What does it say in the Epic of Gilgamesh? Has the poisonous breath of the heavenly beast smitten you? Alberto Tulli, formerly keeper of the Egyptian department in the Vatican Museum, found a fragment of a text from the time of Thumosa III, who lived about 1500 B.C. It relates the tradition that the scribes saw a ball of fire come down from heaven and that its breath had an evil smell. Thumosa and his soldiers watched this spectacle until the ball of fire rose in a southerly direction and disappeared from view. All the texts quoted date from millennia before our era. The authors lived on different continents and belonged to different cultures and religions. There were no special messengers to spread the news in those days, and intercontinental journeys were not an everyday occurrence. In spite of this, traditions telling almost the same story come from the four corners of the world and from innumerable sources. Did all their authors have the same bee in their bonnet? Were they all haunted by the same phenomenon? It is impossible and incredible that the chroniclers of the Mahabharata, the Bible, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the texts of the Eskimos, the American Indians, the Scandinavians, the Tibetans, and many, many other sources should all tell the same stories of flying gods, strange heavenly vehicles, and the frightful catastrophes connected with these apparitions, by chance and without any foundation. They cannot all have had the same ideas all over the world. The almost uniform texts can stem only from facts, that is, from prehistoric events. They related what was actually there to see. Even if the reporter in the remote past may have exaggerated his story with fanciful trimmings, much as newsmen do today, the fact, the actual incident, still remains at the core of all exclusive accounts, as it does today. And that incident obviously cannot have been invented in so many places in different ages. Let us make up an example. A helicopter lands in the African bush for the first time. None of the natives has ever seen such a machine. The helicopter lands in a clearing with a sinister clatter. Pilots in battle dress with crash helmets and machine guns jump out of it. The savage in his loincloth stands stupefied and uncomprehending in the presence of this thing that has come down from heaven and the unknown gods who came with it. After a time, the helicopter takes off again and disappears into the sky. Once he is alone again, the savage has to work out and interpret this apparition. He will tell others who were not present what he saw. A bird, a heavenly vehicle that made a terrible noise and stank, and white-skinned creatures carrying weapons that spat fire. The miraculous visit is fixed and handed down for all time. When the father tells it to his son, the heavenly bird obviously does not get any smaller, and the creatures that got out of it become weirder, stronger, and more imposing. These and many other embellishments will be added to the story. But the premise for the glorious legend was the actual landing of the helicopter. It did land in the clearing in the jungle, and the pilots did climb out of it. From that moment, the event is perpetuated in the mythology of the tribe. Certain things cannot be made up. I should not be ransacking our prehistory for space travelers and heavenly aircraft if accounts of such apparitions appeared in only two or three ancient books. But when in fact nearly all the texts of the primitive peoples all over the globe tell the same story, I feel I must try to explain the objective thrust concealed in their pages. Son of man, thou dwellest in the midst of a rebellious house, which have eyes to see and see not. They have ears to hear and hear not. Ezekiel chapter 12, verse 2. We know that all the Sumerian gods had their counterparts in certain stars. There is supposed to have been a statue to Marduk, Mars, the highest of the gods, that weighed 800 talents of pure gold. If we are to believe Herodotus, that is equivalent to more than 48,000 pounds of gold. Ninurta, Sirius, was judge of the universe and passed sentence on mortal men. There are cuneiform tablets which were addressed to Mars, to Sirius, and to the Pleiades. Time and again Sumerian hymns and prayers mentioned divine weapons, the form and effect of which must have been completely senseless to the people of those days. A panegyric to Mars says that he made fire rain down and destroyed his enemies with a brilliant lightning flash. Inanna is described as she traverses the heavens, radiating a frightful blinding gleam and annihilating the houses of the enemy. Drawings and even the model of a home have been found resembling a prefabricated atomic bunker, round and massive, with a single, strangely framed aperture. From the same period, about 3000 BC, archaeologists have found a model of a team with chariot and driver, as well as two sportsmen wrestling, all of immaculate craftsmanship. The Sumerians, it has been proved, were masters of applied art. Then why did they model a clumsy bunker, when other excavations at Babylon or Uruk have brought much subtler works to light? Quite recently, a whole Sumerian library of about 60,000 clay tablets was found in the town of Nippur, 95 miles south of Baghdad. We now possess the oldest account of the flood, engraved on a tablet in six columns. Five antediluvian cities are named on the tablet: Eridu, Batibira, Larak, Sitpar, and Shurupak. Two of these cities have not yet been discovered. On these tablets, the oldest deciphered to date, the Noah of the Sumerians, is called Zeusudra. He is supposed to have lived in Shurupak, and also to have built his ark there. So we now possess an even older description of the flood than the one in the Epic of Gilgamesh. No one knows whether new finds will not produce still earlier accounts. The men of the ancient cultures seem to have been almost obsessed with the idea of immortality or rebirth. Servants and slaves obviously lay down voluntarily in the tomb with their masters. In the burial chamber of Shub'at, no less than 70 skeletons lay next to each other in perfect order. Without the least sign of violence, sitting or lying in their brilliantly colored robes, they awaited the death which must have come swiftly and painlessly, perhaps by poison. With unshakable conviction, they looked forward to a new life beyond the grave with their masters. But who put the idea of rebirth into the heads of these heathen peoples? The Egyptian pantheon is just as confusing. The ancient texts of the people on the Nile also tell of mighty beings who traversed the firmament in boats. A cuneiform text to the sun god Ra runs, "Thou couplest under the stars and the moon, thou drawest the ship of Aten in heaven and on earth, like the tirelessly revolving stars and the stars at the north pole that do not set." Here is an inscription from a pyramid, "Thou art he who directs the sunship of millions of years." Even if the old Egyptian mathematicians were very advanced, it is odd that they should speak of millions of years in connection with the stars and a heavenly ship. What does the Mahabharata say? Time is the seed of the universe. In Memphis, the god Ptah handed the king two models with which to celebrate the anniversaries of his reign, and commanded him to celebrate the said anniversaries for 6 times 100,000 years. When the god Ptah came to give the king the models, he appeared in a gleaming heavenly chariot, and afterward disappeared over the horizon in it. Today, representations of the winged sun and a soaring falcon carrying the sign of eternity and eternal life can still be found on doors and temples at Idfu. There is no known place in the world where such innumerable illustrations of winged symbols of the gods are preserved as in Egypt. Every tourist knows the island of Elephantine with the famous Nilometer at Aswan. The island is called Elephantine even in the oldest texts, because it was supposed to resemble an elephant. The texts were quite right. The island does look like an elephant. But how did the ancient Egyptians know that? This shape can be recognized only from an airplane at a great height, for there is no hill offering a view of the island that would prompt anyone to make the comparison. A recently discovered inscription on a building at Idfu says that the edifice is of supernatural origin. The ground plan was drawn by the deified being Imhotep. Now, this Imhotep was a very mysterious and clever personality, the Einstein of his time. He was priest, scribe, doctor, architect, and philosopher rolled into one. In this ancient world, the age of Imhotep, according to archaeologists, the only tools the people could have used for working stone were wooden wedges and copper, neither of which is suitable for cutting up granite blocks. Yet the brilliant Imhotep built the step pyramid of Saqqara for his king, who was called Zoser. This 197-foot-high edifice is built with a mastery that Egyptian architects were never quite able to equal afterward. The structure, surrounded by a wall 33 feet high and 1,750 feet long, was called the House of Eternity by Imhotep. He had himself buried in it so that the gods could wake him on their return. We know that all the pyramids were laid out according to the positions of certain stars. Is not this knowledge a bit embarrassing in view of the fact that we have very little evidence of Egyptian astronomy? Sirius was one of the few stars they took an interest in, but this very interest in Sirius seems rather peculiar, because seen from Memphis, Sirius can be observed only in the early dawn just above the horizon when the Nile floods begin. To fill the measure of confusion to overflowing, there was an accurate calendar in Egypt 4,221 years before our era. This calendar was based on the rise of Sirius, first Taut, equals July 19, and gave annual cycles of more than 32,000 years. Admittedly, the old astronomers had plenty of time to observe the sun, the moon, and the stars year in, year out, until they finally decided that all the stars stand in the same place again after approximately 365 days, but surely it was quite absurd to base the first calendar on Sirius when it would have been easier to use the sun and the moon, besides leading to more accurate results. Presumably the Sirius calendar is a built-up system, a theory of probabilities, because it could never predict the appearance of the star. If Sirius appeared on the horizon at dawn at the same time as the Nile flood, it was pure coincidence. A Nile flood did not happen every year, nor did every Nile flood take place on the same day. In which case, why a Sirius calendar? Is there an old tradition here, too? Was there a text or a promise which was carefully guarded by the priesthood? The tomb in which a gold necklace and the skeleton of an entirely unknown animal were found probably belonged to King Udimu. Where did the animal come from? How can we explain the fact that the Egyptians had a decimal system already at the beginning of the first dynasty? How did such a highly developed civilization arise at such an early date? Where do objects of copper and bronze originate as early as the beginning of the Egyptian culture? Who gave them their incredible knowledge of mathematics and a ready-made writing? Before we deal with some monumental buildings which raise innumerable questions, let us take another brief glance at the old texts. Where did the narrators of the Thousand and One Nights get their staggering wealth of ideas? How did anyone come to describe a lamp from which a magician spoke when the owner wished? What daring imagination invented the open sesame incident in the tale of Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Of course, such ideas no longer astonish us today, for the television set shows us talking pictures at the turn of a switch, and as the doors of most large department stores open by photocells, even the Open Sesame incident no longer conceals any special mystery. Nevertheless, the imaginative power of the old storytellers was so incredible that the books of contemporary writers of science fiction seem banal in comparison. So it must be that the ancient storytellers had a store of things already seen, known, and experienced ready at hand to spark off their imagination. In the legendary and saga-like world of intangible cultures, which as yet offer us no fixed points of reference, we are on still shakier ground, and things become even more confusing. Naturally, the Icelandic and old Norwegian traditions also mention gods who travel in the sky. The goddess Frigg has a maidservant called Gna. The goddess sends her handmaid to different worlds on a steed which rises in the air above land and sea. The steed is called Hoof-Thrower, and once, says the saga, Gna met some strange creatures high in the air. In the Alvislied, different names are given to the earth, the sun, the moon, and the universe, depending on whether they are seen from the point of view of men, gods, giants, or dwarves. How on earth could people in the dim past arrive at different perceptions of one and the same thing, when the horizon was very limited? Although the scholar Snorri Sturluson did not write down the Nordic and Old Germanic legends, sagas, and songs until about A.D. 1200, they are known to be some thousands of years old. In these writings, the symbol of the world is often described as a disc or a ball, remarkably enough, and Thor, the leader of the gods, is always shown with a hammer, the destroyer. Herbert Kern supports the view that the word hammer means stone, dates from the Stone Age, and was transferred to bronze and iron hammers only later. Consequently, Thor and his hammer symbol must have been very ancient, and probably do go back to the Stone Age. Moreover, the word Thor in the Indian Sanskrit legends is Tanayitnu. This could be more or less rendered as the Thunderer. The Nordic Thor, god of gods, is the lord of the Germanic Vanen, who makes the skies unsafe. When arguing about the entirely new aspects that I introduce into investigations of the past, the objection might be made that it is not possible to compile everything in the ancient traditions that points to heavenly apparitions into a sequence of proofs of prehistoric space travel. But that is not what I am doing. I am simply referring to passages in very ancient texts that have no place in the working hypothesis in use up to the present. I am drilling away at those admittedly awkward spots in which scribes, translators, and copyists could have had no idea of the sciences and their products. I also would be quite prepared to consider the translations wrong and the copies not accurate enough if these same false, fancifully embellished traditions were not accepted in their entirety as soon as they can be fitted into the framework of some religion or other. It is unworthy of a scientific investigator to deny something when it upsets his working hypothesis and accept it when it supports his theory. Imagine the shape my theory would take and the strength it would gain if new translations made with a space outlook existed. To help us patiently forge the chain of our thesis a little further, scrolls with fragments of apocalyptic and liturgical texts were recently found near the Dead Sea. Once again, in the apocryphal books of Abraham and Moses, we hear about a heavenly chariot with wheels which spits fire, whereas similar references are lacking in the Ethiopian and Slavic book of Enoch. Behind the being I saw a chariot which had wheels of fire, and every wheel was full of eyes all around, and on the wheels was a throne, and this was covered with fire that flowed around it. Apocryphal Book of Abraham, chapter 18, verses 11 through 12. According to Gershom Scholem's explanation, the throne and chariot symbolism of the Jewish mystics corresponded roughly to that of the Hellenistic and early Christian mystics when they talk about pleroma, abundance of light. That is a respectable explanation, but can it be accepted as scientifically proved? May we simply ask what would be the case if some people had really seen the fiery chariot that is described over and over again? A secret script was used very frequently in the Qumran scrolls. Among the documents in the fourth cave, different kinds of characters alternated one and the same astrological work. An astronomical observation bears the title, Words of the Judicious One, which he has addressed to all sons of the dawn. But what is the crushing and convincing objection to the possibility that real fiery chariots were described in the ancient texts? Surely not the vague and stupid assertion that fiery chariots cannot have existed in antiquity. Such an answer would be unworthy of the men I am trying to force to face new alternatives with my questions. Lastly, it is by no means so long ago that reputable scholars said that no stones, meteors, could fall from the sky because there were no stones in the sky. Even 19th-century mathematicians came to the conclusion, convincing in their day, that a railway train would not be able to travel faster than 21 miles an hour because if it did, the air would be forced out of it and the passengers would suffocate. Less than 100 years ago, it was proved that an object heavier than air would never be able to fly. A review in a reputable newspaper classed Walter Sullivan's book We Are Not Alone as science fiction and said that even in the most distant future, it would be quite impossible to reach, say, Epsilon Eridani or Tau Ceti. Even the effect of a shift in time or deep freezing the astronauts could never overcome the barriers of the inconceivable distances. It is a good thing that there were always enough bold visionaries oblivious to contemporary criticism in the past. Without them, there would be no worldwide railway network today, with trains traveling at 124 miles an hour and more. Nota bene, passengers die at more than 21 miles per hour. Without them, there would be no jet aircraft today, because they would certainly fall to the ground. Things that are heavier than air cannot fly. And there would be no moon rockets. Man cannot leave his own planet. There are so many, many things that would not exist but for the visionaries. A number of scholars would like to stick to the so-called realities. In so doing, they are too ready and willing to forget that what is reality today may have been the utopian dream of a visionary yesterday. We owe a considerable number of all the epoch-making discoveries that our age thinks of as realities to lucky chances, not to steady, systematic research. And some of them stand to the credit of the serious visionaries who overcame restricting prejudice with their bold speculations. For example, Heinrich Schliemann accepted Homer's Odyssey as more than stories and fables, and discovered Troy as a result. We still know too little about our past to be able to make a definite judgment about it. New finds may solve unprecedented mysteries. The reading of ancient narratives is capable of turning whole worlds of realities upside down. Incidentally, it is obvious to me that more old books were destroyed than are preserved. There is supposed to have been a book in South America that contained all the wisdom of antiquity. It is reputed to have been destroyed by the 63rd Inca ruler, Pachacuti IV. In the Library of Alexandria, 500,000 volumes belonging to the learned Ptolemy Soter contained all the traditions of mankind. The library was partly destroyed by the Romans, and the rest was burned on the orders of Caliph Omar centuries later. An incredible thought that invaluable and irreplaceable manuscripts were used to heat the public baths of Alexandria. What became of the library of the Temple at Jerusalem? What became of the library of Pergamon, which is supposed to have housed 200,000 works? When the Chinese Emperor Qi Huang ordered the destruction of a mass of historical, astronomical, and philosophical books for political reasons in 214 B.C., what treasures and secrets went with them? How many texts did the converted Paul cause to be destroyed at Ephesus? And we cannot even imagine the enormous wealth of literature about all branches of knowledge that has been lost to us owing to religious fanaticism. How many thousands of irretrievable writings did monks and missionaries burn in South America in their blind religious zeal? That happened hundreds and thousands of years ago. Has mankind learned anything as a result? Only half a century ago, Hitler had books burned in the public squares, and as recently as 1966, the same thing happened in China during Mao's kindergarten revolution. Thank heavens that today books do not exist in single copies as in the past. The texts and fragments, still available, transmit a great deal of knowledge from the remote past. In all ages, the sages of a nation knew that the future would always bring wars and revolutions, blood and fire. Did this knowledge perhaps lead these sages to hide secrets and traditions from the mob and the colossal buildings of their period, or to preserve them from possible destruction in a safe place? Have they hidden information or accounts in pyramids, temples, and statues, or bequeathed them in the form of ciphers so that they would withstand the ravages of time? We certainly ought to test the idea, for far-sighted contemporaries of our own day have acted in this way, for the future. In 1965, Americans buried in the soil of New York two time capsules, so constituted that they could withstand the very worst that this earth could offer in the way of calamities for 5,000 years. These time capsules contained news that we want to transmit to posterity, so that some day those who strive to illuminate the darkness surrounding the past of their forefathers will know how we lived. The capsules are made of a metal that is harder than steel. They can survive even an atomic explosion. In addition to daily news, the capsules contain photographs of cities, ships, automobiles, aircraft, and rockets. They house samples of metals and plastics, of fabrics, threads, and cloths. They hand down to posterity objects in everyday use, such as coins, tools, and toilet articles, books about mathematics, medicine, physics, biology, and astronautics are preserved on microfilm. In order to complete the service for some remote and unknown future race, the capsules also contain a key, a book with the help of which all the written material can be translated into the languages of the future. A group of engineers from Westinghouse Electric had the idea of presenting the time capsules to posterity. John Harrington invented the ingenious decoding system for generations yet unknown. Lunatics? Visionaries? I find the realization of this project beneficial and reassuring. It's nice to know that there are men today who think 5,000 years ahead. The archaeologists of some remote future age will not find things any easier than we did. For after an atomic conflagration, none of the world's libraries will be of any use, and all the achievements that make us so proud will not be worth tuppence, because they have disappeared, because they have been destroyed, because they have been atomized. An atomic conflagration which ravages the earth is not required to justify the New Yorker's imaginative action. A shifting of the earth's axis by a few degrees would cause inundations on an unprecedented and irresistible scale. In any case, they would swallow up every single written word. Who is arrogant enough to assert that the sages of old could not have conceived the same sort of idea as the far-sighted New Yorkers? Undoubtedly, the strategists of an A-bomb and H-bomb war will not direct their weapons against Zulu villages and harmless Eskimos. They will use them against the centers of civilization. In other words, the radioactive chaos will fall on the advanced, most highly developed peoples. Savages and primitive peoples far away from the centers of civilization will be left. They will not be able to transmit our culture, or even give an account of it, because they have never taken part in it. Even intelligent men and visionaries who tried to preserve an underground library will not have been able to help the future a great deal. Normal libraries will be destroyed in any case, and the surviving primitive peoples will know nothing of the hidden secret libraries. Whole regions of the globe will become burning deserts, because radiation lasting for centuries will not allow any plants to grow. The survivors will presumably be mutated, and after 2,000 years, nothing will be left of the annihilated cities. The unbridled power of nature will eat its way through the ruins. Iron and steel will rust and crumble into dust. And everything will begin again. Man may embark on his adventure a second or even a third time. Perhaps once again he will take so long to reemerge as a civilized being that the secrets of old traditions and texts will be closed to him. 5,000 years after the catastrophe, archaeologists could claim that 20th century man was not yet familiar with iron, because, understandably enough, they would not find any, no matter how hard they dug. Along the Russian frontiers they would find miles of concrete tank traps, and they would explain that such finds undoubtedly indicated astronomical lines. If they were to find cassettes with tapes, they would not know what to do with them. They would not even be able to distinguish between played and unplayed tapes. and perhaps those tapes might hold the solution to many, many puzzles. Texts which spoke of gigantic cities with houses several hundred feet high would be pooh-poohed, because such cities could not have existed. Scholars would take the London tube tunnels for a geometrical curiosity or an astonishingly well-conceived drainage system. And they might keep on coming across reports which described how men flew from continent to continent with giant birds and referred to extraordinary fire-spitting ships which disappeared into the sky. That would also be dismissed as mythology, because such great birds and fire-spitting ships could not have existed. Things would be made very difficult for the translators in the year 7000. The facts about a world war in the 20th century that they would discover from fragmentary texts would sound quite incredible. But when the speeches of Marx and Lenin fell into their hands, they would at last be able to make two high priests of this incomprehensible age the center of a religion. What a piece of luck! People would be able to explain a great deal, provided sufficient clues were still in existence. 5,000 years is a long time. It is pure caprice on nature's part that she allows dressed blocks of stone to survive for 5,000 years. She does not deal so carefully with the thickest iron girders. In the courtyard of a temple in Delhi, there exists, as I have already mentioned, a column made of welded iron parts that has been exposed to weathering for more than 4,000 years without showing a trace of rust. In addition, it is unaffected by sulfur or phosphorus. Here we have an unknown alloy from antiquity staring us in the face. Perhaps the column was cast by a group of far-sighted engineers who did not have the resources for a colossal building, but wanted to bequeath to posterity a visible, time-defying monument to their culture. It is an embarrassing story. In advanced cultures of the past, we find buildings that we cannot copy today with the most modern technical means. These stone masses are there. They cannot be argued away. Because that which ought not to exist cannot exist, there is a frantic search for rational explanations. Let us take off our blinkers and join the search. Chapter 7. Ancient Marvels or Space Travel Centers. To the north of Damascus lies the Terrace of Baalbek, a platform built of stone blocks, some of which have sides more than 65 feet long and weigh nearly 2,000 tons. Until now, archaeologists have not been able to give a convincing explanation why, how, and by whom the Terrace of Baalbek was built. However, Russian Professor Agrest considers it possible that the terrace is the remains of a gigantic airfield. If we meekly accept the neat package of knowledge that the Egyptologists serve up to us, ancient Egypt appears suddenly and without transition with a fantastic ready-made civilization. Great cities and enormous temples, colossal statues with tremendous expressive power, splendid streets flanked by magnificent sculptures, perfect drainage systems, luxurious tombs carved out of the rock, pyramids of overwhelming size, these and many other wonderful things shot out of the ground, so to speak. Genuine miracles in a country that is suddenly capable of such achievements without recognizable prehistory. Fertile agricultural land exists only in the Nile Delta and on small strips to the left and right of the river. Yet experts now estimate the number of inhabitants at the time of the building of the Great Pyramid at 50 million. A figure, incidentally, that flagrantly contradicts the 20 million considered to be the total population of the world in 3000 BC. With such enormous estimates, a couple of million men, more or less, does not matter. But one thing is clear. They all had to be fed. There was not only a host of construction workers, stonemasons, engineers, and sailors. There were not only hundreds of thousands of slaves, but also a well-equipped army, a large and pampered priesthood, countless merchants, farmers, and officials, and last but not least, the pharaonic household living on the fat of the land. Could they all have lived on the scanty yields of agriculture in the Nile Delta? I shall be told that the stone blocks used for building the temple were moved on rollers. In other words, wooden rollers. But the Egyptians could scarcely have felled and turned into rollers the few trees, mainly palms, that then, as now, grew in Egypt, because the dates from the palms were urgently needed for food, and the trunks and fronds were the only things giving shade to the dried-up ground. but they must have been wooden rollers. Otherwise, there would not be even the feeblest technical explanation of the building of the pyramids. Did the Egyptians import wood? In order to import wood, there must have been a sizable fleet, and even after it had been landed in Alexandria, the wood would have had to be transported up the Nile to Cairo. Since the Egyptians did not have horses and carts at the time of the building of the Great Pyramid, there was no other possibility. The horse and cart was not introduced until the 17th dynasty, about 1600 BC. My kingdom for a convincing explanation of the transport of the stone blocks. Of course, the scholars say that wooden rollers were needed. There are many problems connected with the technology of the pyramid builders, and no genuine solutions. How did the Egyptians carve tombs out of the rock? What resources did they have in order to lay out a maze of galleries and rooms? The walls are smooth and mostly decorated with paintings in relief. The shafts slope down into the rocky soil. They have steps built in the best tradition of craftsmanship that lead to the burial chambers far below. Hordes of tourists stand gaping in amazement at them, but none of them gets an explanation of the mysterious technique used in their excavation. Yet it is firmly established that the Egyptians were masters of the art of tunneling from the earliest times, for the old rock-cut tombs are worked in exactly the same way as the more recent ones. There is no difference between the tomb of Teti from the 6th dynasty and the tomb of Ramses I from the New Kingdom, although there is a minimum of 1,000 years between the building of the two tombs. Obviously, the Egyptians had not learned anything new to add to their old technique. In fact, the more recent edifices tend increasingly to be poor copies of their ancient models. The tourist who bumps his way to the Pyramid of Cheops to the west of Cairo on a camel called Wellington or Napoleon, depending on his nationality, gets the strange sensation in the pit of his stomach that relics of the mysterious past always produce. The guide tells him that a pharaoh had a burial place built here, and with that bit of rehashed erudition he rides homeward, after taking some impressive photographs. The Pyramid of Cheops, in particular, has inspired hundreds of crazy and untenable theories. In the 600-page book, Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid, by Charles Piazzi Smith, published in 1864, we can read about many hair-raising links between the pyramid and our globe. Yet even after a highly critical examination, it still contains some facts that should stimulate us to reflection. It is well known that the ancient Egyptians practiced a solar religion. Their sun god, Ra, traveled through the heavens in a bark. Pyramid texts of the Old Kingdom even describe heavenly journeys by the king, obviously made with the help of the gods and their boats. So the gods and kings of the Egyptians were also involved with flying. Is it really a coincidence that the height of the Pyramid of Cheops, multiplied by 1,000,000,000, 98 million miles, corresponds approximately to the distance between the Earth and Sun? Is it a coincidence that a meridian running through the pyramids divides continents and oceans into two exactly equal halves? Is it coincidence that the area of the base of the pyramid divided by twice its height gives the celebrated figure pi equals 3.14159? Is it coincidence that calculations of the weight of the Earth were found, and is it also coincidence that the rocky ground on which the structure stands is carefully and accurately leveled? There is not a single clue to explain why the builder of the Pyramid of Cheops, the Pharaoh Khufu, chose that particular rocky terrain in the desert as the site for his edifice. It is conceivable that there was a natural cleft in the rock which he made use of for the colossal building, while another explanation, though only a feeble one, may be that he wanted to watch the progress of the work from his summer palace. Both reasons are against all common sense. In the first case, it would certainly have been more practical to locate the building site nearer the eastern quarries in order to shorten transport distances. And second, it is hard to imagine that the pharaoh wanted to be disturbed year after year by the din that filled building sites day and night, even in those days. Since there is so much to be said against the textbook explanations of the choice of site, one might reasonably ask whether the gods did not have their say here too, even if it was by way of the priesthood. But if that explanation is accepted, there is one more important proof of my theory of the utopian past of mankind. For the pyramid not only divides continents and oceans into two equal halves, It also lies at the center of gravity of the continents. If the facts noted here are not coincidences, and it seems extremely difficult to believe that they are, then the building site was chosen by beings who knew all about the spherical shape of the Earth and the distribution of continents and seas. In this connection, let us not forget Piri Reis's maps. It cannot all be coincidence, or be explained away as fairy stories. With what power, with what machines, with what technical resources was the rocky terrain leveled at all? How did the master builders drive the tunnels downward? And how did they illuminate them? Neither here nor in the rock-cut tombs in the Valley of Kings were torches or anything similar used. There are no blackened ceilings or walls or even the slightest evidence that traces of blackening have been removed. How and with what were the stone blocks cut out of the quarries? With sharp edges and smooth sides? How were they transported and joined together to the thousandth of an inch? Once again, there is a wealth of explanations for anyone to choose from. Inclined planes and tracks along which the stones were pushed, scaffolding and ramps, and naturally the labor of many hundreds of thousands of Egyptian slaves, fellahin, builders and craftsmen. None of these explanations stands up to a critical examination. The Great Pyramid is and remains visible testimony of a technique that has never been understood. Today in the 20th century, no architect could build a copy of the Pyramid of Cheops, even if the technical resources of every continent were at his disposal. 2,600,000 gigantic blocks were cut out of the quarries, dressed and transported, and fitted together on the building site to the nearest thousandth of an inch. And deep down inside in the galleries, the walls were painted in colors. The site of the pyramid was a whim of the pharaoh. The unparalleled classical dimensions of the pyramid occurred to the master builder by chance. Several hundred thousand workers pushed and pulled blocks weighing 12 tons up a ramp with non-existent ropes on non-existent rollers. This host of workers lived on non-existent grain. They slept in non-existent huts, which the pharaoh had built outside his summer palace. The workers were urged on by an encouraging heave-ho over a non-existent loudspeaker, and so the 12-ton blocks were pushed skyward. If the industrious workers had achieved the extraordinary daily piece rate of 10 blocks piled on top of each other, they would have assembled the 2,600,000 stone blocks into the magnificent stone pyramid in about 250,000 days, 664 years. Yes, and don't forget that the whole thing came into being at the whim of an eccentric king who never lived to see the completion of the edifice he had inspired. Of course, one must not even suggest that this theory, so seriously advanced, is ridiculous. Yet who is so ingenious as to believe that the pyramid was nothing but the tomb of a king? From now on, who will consider the transmission of mathematical and astronomical signs as pure chance? Today, the Great Pyramid is undisputedly attributed to the pharaoh Khufu as inspirer and builder. Why? Because all the inscriptions and tablets refer to Khufu. It seems obvious to me that the pyramid cannot have been erected during a single lifetime. But what if Khufu forged the inscriptions and tablets that are supposed to proclaim his fame? That was quite a popular procedure in antiquity, as many buildings bear witness. Whenever a dictatorial ruler wanted the fame for himself alone, he gave orders for this process to be carried out. If that was the case, then the pyramid existed long before Khufu left his visiting card. In the Bodleian Library at Oxford, there is a manuscript in which the Coptic author Mas'udi asserts that the Egyptian king Surid had the Great Pyramid built. Oddly enough, this Surid ruled in Egypt before the flood. And this wise king Surid ordered his priests to write down the sum total of their wisdom and conceal the writings inside the pyramid. So, according to the Coptic tradition, the pyramid was built before the flood. Herodotus confirms such a supposition in Book 2 of his history. The priests of Thebes had shown him 341 colossal statues, each of which stood for a high priestly generation over a period of 11,340 years. Now, we know that every high priest had a statue made during his own lifetime, and Herodotus also tells us that during his stay in Thebes, one priest after another showed him his statue as a proof that the son had always followed the father. The priests assured Herodotus that their statements were very accurate because they had written everything down for many generations, and they explained that every one of these 341 statues represented a generation. Before these 341 generations, the gods had lived among men, and since then, no god had visited them again in human form. The historical period of Egypt is usually estimated at about 6,500 years. Then why did the priests lie so shamelessly to the traveler Herodotus about their 11,340 years? And why did they so expressly emphasize that no gods had dwelt among them for 341 generations? These precise details would have been completely pointless if gods had not really lived among men in the remote past. We know next to nothing about the how, why, and when of the building of the pyramid. An artificial mountain, some 490 feet high and weighing 6,500,000 tons, stands there as evidence of an incredible achievement, and this monument is supposed to be nothing more than the burial place of an extravagant king. Anyone who can believe that explanation is welcome to it. Mummies, equally incomprehensible and not yet convincingly explained, stare at us from the remote past as if they held some magic secret. Various peoples knew the technique of embalming corpses, and archaeological finds favor the supposition that prehistoric beings believed in corporeal return to a second life. That interpretation would be acceptable if there was even the remotest evidence of a belief in a corporeal return in the religious philosophy of antiquity. If our primitive ancestors had believed in only a spiritual return, they would scarcely have gone to such trouble with the dead. But finds in Egyptian tombs provide example after example of the preparation of embalmed corpses for a corporeal return. What the evidence says, what visible proof says, cannot be so absurd. Drawings and sagas actually indicated that the gods promised to return from the stars in order to awaken the well-preserved bodies to new life. That is why the provisioning of the embalmed corpses in the burial chambers took such a practical form and was intended for a life on this side of the grave. Otherwise, what were they supposed to have done with money, jewelry, and their favorite articles? And as they were even provided in the tomb with some of their servants, who were unquestionably buried alive, the point of all the preparations was obviously the continuation of the old life in a new life. The tombs were tremendously durable and solid, almost atom bomb proof. They could survive the ravages of all the ages. The valuables left in them, gold and precious stones, were virtually indestructible. I am not concerned here with discussing the later abuses of mummification. I am only concerned with the question, who put the idea of corporeal rebirth into the heads of the heathens? And whence came the first audacious idea that the cells of the body had to be preserved so that the corpse, preserved in a very secure place, could be awakened to new life after thousands of years? So far, this mysterious reawakening complex has only been considered from the religious point of view. But supposing the pharaoh, who certainly knew more about the nature and customs of the gods than his subjects, had these possibly quite crazy ideas. I must make a burial place for myself that cannot be destroyed for millennia and is visible far across the country. The gods promise to return and wake me up, or doctors in the distant future will discover a way to restore me to life again. What have we to say about that in the space age? In his book, The Prospect of Immortality, published in 1965, physician and astronomer Robert C. W. Ettinger suggests a way in which 20th century men can have ourselves frozen so that our cells can go on living from the medical and biological point of view, but slowed down a billionfold. For the present, this idea may still sound utopian, but in fact, every big clinic today has a bone bank which preserves human bones in a deep frozen condition for years and makes them serviceable again when required. Fresh blood, this, too, is a universal practice, can be kept for an unlimited time at minus 196 degrees centigrade. And living cells can be stored almost indefinitely at the temperature of liquid nitrogen. Did the pharaoh have a fantastic idea which will soon be realized in practice? You must listen to what follows twice to grasp the fantastic implications of the result of the next piece of scientific research. In March 1963, biologists of the University of Oklahoma confirmed that the skin cells of the Egyptian Princess Mene were capable of living. And Princess Mene has been dead for several thousand years. There have been finds in many places of mummies which are preserved so completely and intact that they seem to be alive. Glacier mummies left by the Incas survived the ages, and theoretically they are capable of living. Utopia? In the summer of 1965, Russian television showed two dogs which had been deep frozen for a week. On the seventh day, they were thawed out again, and, hey presto, they went on living as cheerfully as ever. Americans, and this is no secret, are seriously concerned, as part of their space program, with the problem of how to freeze astronauts of the future for their long journey to distant stars. Dr. Attinger, often scoffed at today, prophesies a remote future in which men will not be consumed by fire or eaten by worms,